Ken, you and I both have spoken at great length about how many mysteries of the unknown and unexplained captivated us when we were kids, and some of those mysteries remain unexplained. We were talking about the Bermuda Triangle just the other day. Whatever happened with that? Did we just decide to stop investigating it after all of those planes and ships disappeared? Well, you probably enjoy, as I do, Expedition Unknown, a television show that's now starting its 13th season on Discovery. And lucky for us, there's a podcast called Expedition Unknown, where the host, Josh Gates, investigates unsolved, iconic stories across the globe. This is right out of our playbook. With direct audio from the hit TV show, we'll hear Gates explore stories like the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, which we've talked about on our show, to the location of Captain Morgan's treasure in Panama, which, as far as I know, we have never talked about on our show. But these authentic, roughshod journeys help Gates separate fact from fiction and learn the truth behind compelling stories. And wait for it, he investigates the mysteries of the Bermuda Triangle. His investigation led him to the ocean floor, to the skies above, and even the edge of space to tackle some of the most intriguing disappearances in history. And this is what I've been saying to you, Ken. It isn't just the ocean floor. It goes to the very edge of space. And in the conclusion of his epic investigation, Josh used cutting-edge technology to investigate the Triangle's most infamous shipwrecks and lost flights. Will he find answers to just how the Triangle works, or will it forever remain a mystery? Tune in to Expedition Unknown wherever you get your podcasts.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1227.PR2027, certificate number 42453, the Saint-Martin fistula.
Because I put myself out there every day. You know, I write online profiles and I check the boxes that say I like hiking and dogs.
Is there a box for fistulas? Because that's what I want. A guy that can talk fistulas.
Saint Martin.
He's French Canadian.
Saint Martin.
So his fistula is the Saint Martin fistula.
The Saint Martin fistula.
Fistula. It does sound like a good word to say in French.
Fistula.
Like you're the chef from The Little Mermaid.
Yeah, right. It's something you could say in a kind of angry, contemptuous way.
Do you know what a fistula is? It looks like you would say it in a Transylvanian accent, right?
Fistula.
Count Fistula. It's like Blackula, but he's not black. He's just a fist.
A fistula is some kind of passageway?
Yeah, essentially. It's when...
It's an organic passageway.
Yeah, it's when two organs in the body, you know, two passageways in the body, whether that's digestive, alimentary, or whether it's two blood vessels,
connect in some way they're not supposed to.
Or they merge or morph or something.
Yeah. Like a little shortcut. Let's think of it that way.
It is biological, but it's not just contained to human bodies, right? You can have a fistula in between plants.
Between roads? Oh, I see. A fistula in a plant.
Yeah. I think it is always biological. It's not like, a fistula within a cave system.
Right. It has to be biological.
But it can happen in plants and it's not just in bodies.
Like if you make a shortcut in your hedge maze, that's not a fistula.
What if you put a bustle in your hedgerow? Should I be alarmed?
I know you've got a big hedge maze out back, like the one in The Shining.
I'm killing Jack Nicholson's out there all winter long.
They just keep popping up. Little Jack Nicholson head pops up out of your lawn like a gopher and says, "Here's Johnny."
They're like stink bugs. They got introduced somehow into my yard, and now I'm just fighting Jack Nicholson.
The invasive Nicholsons.
Yeah,
you know, the Mississippi River used to keep them out of the West, but...
Yeah, ever since they built those bridges, Nicholson's Nicholson's everywhere. Well, and it's Nicholson's all the way down, too.
Yeah, they just, they now that they can fly over the cuckoo nests, they can just get anywhere. Fistula is usually biological. It's usually some kind of trauma, whether an injury or a surgery. Mm. Like anytime somebody needs dialysis, you know, you're essentially creating, you know, a place where deoxygenated blood and oxygenated blood merges. Like you're adding a second external heart to your body, essentially.
Yeah, sure.
So to do that, you've got to add a new nexus between an artery and a vein. And so that's what they do. They just go through a wall.
But if you get dialysis, is it ever a case where a fistula is created that then doesn't close?
Oh.
No, I guess it wouldn't be because the needle going in is both the entrance and the exit. It's just creating another loop.
Yes. I guess the fistula would be in the dialysis?
Yeah, but if it wouldn't stay open once you took the dialysis needle out. A fistula is
sure,
something
like
that
when
stays open.
When you donate blood, the hole doesn't stay there forever.
Right. You're not taking oxygen in then from that hole just as you walk around.
A lot of the times their fistulas are excretory or gynecological in nature.
Oh, I see.
Or both.
In your lower regions.
Which you don't want to. It's a common trauma of childbirth is that the birth canal gets a little window it doesn't want. And the result is incontinence because urine and feces can then get into the
same channel
reproductive parts, which is probably, unless you're into that, you know, it's a huge health problem.
Yeah. And this is something, I mean, we are getting deep into the gross out weeds. I hope none of the futurelings are busy eating, you know, their handfuls of bugs or whatever it is that people in the future or things in the future consume.
My sister was eating rice pudding during the floating feet episode, and she still has not forgiven you for that.
You know, I've always felt like it's received wisdom that you do not eat during a podcast because anything can happen in a podcast.
Well, I feel like it's respect. It's a matter of respect.
Oh, I see. Sure.
Don't sit there eating. Like when they cut to the audience in the Oscars, like nobody's got a corn dog.
Right. Yeah. Well, your mastication is drowning out our sibilance.
That's right. Like we worked hard on not having a big noise in the back. Like you have to turn a lot of dials to get rid of that.
Yeah.
And yet you're just putting it right back in.
Well, I'm eating peanut butter sandwiches even right now, but you can't tell because our engineers are so talented.
This would be the episode to eat like a big, just be eating Eggo waffles all the way through.
But it is true that your intestines can develop ruptures or fissures that then your gut will fill up with material that isn't meant to be there.
Right. And in this case, the skin is epithelial tissue as well. The skin is an organ.
Yep.
So this is a story about a fistula that opened between the digestive system and the exterior world. It's a little window.
Really?
It's the story of Alexei Saint-Martin. Who was, he's the second entry in the omnibus to be named after a deceased sibling.
Hmm.
You may recall paleontologist Mary Anning.
Oh, right. Mary Anning.
I know you were about to say that.
Yeah. Mary Anning, whose elder sister was Mary Anning.
Right. This is a case where Alexis Saint-Martin from 40 miles north of Montreal, his older brother, Alexis Saint-Martin, I think who was 8, died just months before he was born. And he was the replacement model.
It seems weird for a parent to do that, but I do have two sisters named Susan.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. But that's not a replacement issue.
No, they're both still alive, in fact.
One of them is not the cloned spare parts for your sister Susan, whom I met and who is lovely.
No, I haven't. And you haven't met my other sister Susan, but one day you will. It's not a case, right, where the second child is burdened for the rest of its life trying to shoulder their dead elder sibling whom they never met.
There's a story about, do you want to talk about, is it a combined family or stepfamily situation?
No. They are all biological relatives. We'll talk about it on another episode of The Omnibus, somewhere down the line. It's implausible that one person would have two sisters named Susan, but not impossible.
You can see how you opened up a little conversational fistula there.
It is a conversational fistula.
That I might want to explore with my... with my probing speculum of inquisitiveness.
Yeah, my family dynamic is now exposed to the air, and and you are the doctor.
Well, you're talking about replacement children. I was reading this. There's a story about Robert Benchley where his brother died in the Spanish-American War, and his mom got the telegram at a big summer 4th of July picnic in Worcester, Massachusetts, where they lived. And with her 8-year-old son, Robert Benchley, at her side, she screams out, "Oh, why couldn't it have been Robert?" And he spent his whole life dealing with that, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
Not always successfully.
Why couldn't it? Instead of saying, "Why couldn't it have been me?" Why couldn't right. it have been Robert?
That's how you know a really great mother is the one who says, "Why couldn't it have been the other garbage child?"
Right.
Spare organs. I was keeping him around so that, you know, in case his older brother got hurt in the Spanish-American War.
He would have some organs.
Yeah, he would have a kidney or whatever. Alexis Saint-Martin was a voyageur.
Right, which is a Canadian fur trapper.
Yeah, it sounds very glamorous. You know, oh, you're a voyageur. You're like a minivan or a NASA space probe.
A forest runner.
Yeah, well, there were actually... So a voyageur was a little different than, you know, we think of that as the ultimate kind of, you know, frontiersman, backwoodsman type.
Right.
And by the way, I got dinged on I was recording an audiobook yesterday for my comedy book Now and Say, and I said frontier. And I got shut down. Ken, please say frontier. I looked it up and they're both right, by the way, so I'm still a little annoyed.
This podcast is wearing off on you. My spoonerisms are starting to get inside your head.
This is our big chance to make sure everyone in the future says frontier. Like I do, which is apparently weird.
Frontier.
Does Captain Kirk say it? Does he say space?
The final frontier. No, I don't think so.
He does say frontier. Frontier. The final frontier.
Frontier. I do. I mean, I often say Sasquatch because I grew up.
You were raised by Native Americans. You were raised by the Salish Indians.
I grew up believing in Sasquatches and that they were all around.
Like that was a big part of your family culture?
Well,
every Christmas, Sasquatch is going to come down the chimney.
When I was a little kid, we lived up in Shoreline here in Washington, very close to where you grew up. Mm-hmm. And Lake Forest Park, which then was a less developed suburb
more
than
forest,
it is now.
Less park.
More forest. Somehow I got it into my head that Lake Forest Park was full of Sasquatches.
That's still true. If you go to Third Place Books up there, like the self-help aisle is full of unhappy Sasquatch.
So anytime at night that we were driving through Lake Forest Park, I could hear Leonard Nimoy, you know, recording the like eerie shrieking of distant Sasquatches.
I think it's funny that I don't say frontier the Shatner way, but maybe you do say Sasquatch the Nimoy way.
The Sasquatch. Well, people yell at me all the time, it's Sasquatch. And I'm like, what an ungainly pronunciation of this beautiful creature, this cryptozoological man-beast ape.
You shouldn't have to put up with their sass.
Sasquatch.
Or possibly their
sauce.
Their sauce. Their marinara sauce.
People are constantly giving me extra sauce that I do not want. But voyageurs, you know, I went to Outward Bound in the early 1980s and in Minnesota, and our Outward Bound group was changed. The name was changed to the Voyageurs while I was, I think, the year I was there.
What do you remember what it would have been before?
Oh, it was just like Minnesota Outward Bound. And then they decided that the Outward Bounds were getting more regional specific names.
Needed a little flavor.
But the voyageurs were famous, unlike the frontiersmen of America, they were famous for much more intimate interactions with the First Nations people. They were, you know, they learned the language. They intermarried in some cases.
Canada really nailed First Nations. That's the coolest possible name for your indigenous population.
Coolest.
Whereas we're still kind of arguing between like Indians, which is awful, and Native Americans.
Native Americans, it just feels like First Nations is where it's at.
That's like Battlestar Galactica people.
Yeah.
Let's go find the world of the First Nations.
Well, and it credits them with having indigenous nationhood.
They were first.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Native just means you were born here, but first, that's like, you guys are it. Nobody before you.
And it does, yeah, it does communicate that they are also immigrants, just ones from centuries before, millennia before.
I feel like it's more explicit about conveying the kind of birthright they have.
Right.
That maybe literally every other Canadian does not.
First Nations.
Including Alexis Saint-Martin, who was actually, his grandfather had lived in French Canada. He was not an immigrant himself. He was from old school New Canada stock.
So his grandfather had been one of the early tree walkers, and the voyageurs were more employees, right?
So that's the thing. The name sounds very romantic, like they're Kit Carson or whatever. And there is all this mystique then and now in Canada about the deeds and the exploits of these brave voyageurs. But in fact, they were not lone free agents. Those would be the coureurs de bois.
Coureurs de bois. So they are forest. I had that right.
Yes, literally runners of the woods.
Runners of the woods.
I guess Blanche Dubois is
Blanche of the woods. A white of the woods.
Blanched vegetables of the woods. But the voyageurs were employees. They worked for the fur companies, and they did the grunt work. They were essentially the Sherpas of the Great North Woods. You know, they had to carry canoes over portages. Do we say portage or portage?
In this case, I think portage.
You can't go wrong with the French pronunciation when you're talking about these.
When you're talking about these
burly Quebecois men.
We said during Outward Bound, frankly, we said portage. We're going to portage the canoes from lake to lake. But I think probably now they would say portage.
John, voyagers, portage.
Yeah.
Voyageurs.
They portage.
Portage. Yeah. And maybe there were voyageuses as well. Were there female voyageurs?
I am not going to go on the record saying either way.
I would love to imagine that there were brave voyageuses.
Voyageuse.
That's kind of hard to say.
Voyageuse.
So they had to, you know, these guys had to carry big 90-pound loads of fur, sometimes multiple at a time, you know, two or three or four of these 90-pound loads of beaver fur over 7-mile portages.
Look, who hasn't carried 90 pounds of fur? I mean, I'm carrying it right now.
Every time you stand up. because it was beaver fur, that was the game changer in Europe. They were getting lynx and marten and fox and what we would think of as more beautiful, luxurious furs, but Europe just had this insatiable appetite for beaver furs.
Well, because you could felt beaver fur.
Yes, it's feltable.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what that means.
Well, a lot of the fedoras, like the beautiful hats of the 19th and
men's top 20th hats century, and
a lot of them were, I think top hats even were just beaver. Well, but I think a lot of, even now, there's a hat sitting right there. In fact, over your shoulder here in our studio.
All of the listeners just turned their heads.
Say, what? And there's just this floating hat behind them in a glow.
The hat is coming from inside the house.
But it's felted beaver fur, and I'm not 100% sure the process.
Yeah, I was looking into the process, and the problem is you have to keep seeing the phrase, the underhairs of the beaver. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do paragraphs and paragraphs of that.
Right.
Without making like Beavis and Butthead chortles. So I had to stop. But yeah, it decimated beaver populations because it was these massive fur companies. John Jacob Astor became the richest man in America.
Right.
By just killing hundreds of millions of beavers and making hats. And a lot of it was fashion. I mean, this didn't end until silk became the fashionable thing to make hats of. And that was what saved the beaver. But by then it was too late. You know, many Indian tribes had starved and gone through terrible deprivations because all along the St. Lawrence, their beaver hunting was just killed off by John Jacob Astor's insatiable hunger for beaver.
Well, now they starved. Are you suggesting that they ate beaver?
Yes. Well, I think a lot of them, I think you could eat beaver, and I think the economy was based, their economy was based on the beaver furs they traded as
right,
well.
Right. So it wasn't that John Jacob Astor
was pulling beaver hunks of beaver meat out right. of a hungry.
It was just that the Canadians established beaver as a form of currency.
Yeah, until like the 1990s, I think. Like you go to Canada.
But the First Nations people then became connected to this capitalist exchange, and then the beaver died out, and all of a sudden they were then sort of economically stranded.
Yeah. Do you remember when the Loonies and Toonies first came out in Canada, and people were just like, "Whoa, what's this? I don't have to buy my groceries with beaver furs anymore." Like, sir, it's 1992.
You know, in Anchorage, every year there is a fur rendezvous still where all the trappers come in throughout
fur
Alaska.
Fur rendezvous?
It's called Fur Rendezvous. It's the biggest festival of the year.
Is it
in
all
Alaska.
One word? Fur rendezvous.
No, they call it Fur Rondi. and all the trappers come in and there's an enormous fur auction and people are selling and buying furs. And these guys that trap, it's kind of they're like farmers. They make all their money in one event. All year long, they save up these pelts, and then they bring them all into town and sell them all at once.
But it's a hard life.
It's an awful life.
Unless
you dig it.
Unless you're John Jacob Astor, and you can.
I don't think he ever left New York.
He must have, because he died on the Titanic. He shouldn't have left New York.
Of course.
all those freezing Indians finally got revenge when John Jacob Astor froze to death in the North Atlantic. And Alexis Saint-Martin was one of the lowest kind of voyager. He was a mangeur de lard, a pork eater, literally, mm-hmm. which I guess was the lowest class of grunt in the voyageur community. And we know little about him before the day that changed his life, June 6th, 1822. When he was on Mackinac Island, mm-hmm. which had been British territory. It was taken during the War of 1812, handed back by the Treaty of Ghent. So it's now an American fort. But he's there at the company store, I guess, getting supplies for his latest voyage fantastique mm-hmm. into the woods. Mm-hmm. And something terrible happens to him. Mackinac, have you ever been to Mackinac Island, by
no.
the way? It's in Lake Huron.
No, I've never.
It's a beautiful resort. I've never been there either, but I've seen the movie Somewhere in Time, which makes it look like this delightful Edwardian getaway. But that back then, it was just a rough and tumble fort military garrison.
Sure, like everything. I mean, back in time, Indianapolis, Indiana was a frontier town.
Right. Did it still have the beautiful, wide, tree-lined boulevards, or is that some later utopian vision?
That came later. I think it was just a bunch of mud holes in the ground while they were all fighting Tecumseh.
And it's kind of going to turn back into that, right? All those Midwestern towns are returning to their natural state.
Well, yeah, they're...
No, I'm just kidding. Indianapolis is lovely.
It's a beautiful city. You know, Indiana does keep voting for regressive politics, and little by little, I think it probably will return to the soil.
I like how we're covering our butts just in case Indianapolis is the capital of the United Federation of Planets in the future.
Right. And I mean, it's literally called Indianapolis.
What is that? I guess what? City of Indians.
First Nation Annapolis.
That's true. I guess that's one advantage we have is we can call a place Indiana. You can't, you know.
Right.
First Nation Indiana is a little unwieldy.
Aye. Ken, you and I both have spoken at great length about how many mysteries of the unknown and unexplained captivated us when we were kids, and some of those mysteries remain unexplained. We were talking about the Bermuda Triangle just the other day. Whatever happened with that? Did we just decide to stop investigating it after all of those planes and ships disappeared? Well, you probably enjoy, as I do, Expedition Unknown, a television show that's now starting its 13th season on Discovery. And lucky for us, there's a podcast called Expedition Unknown, where the host, Josh Gates, investigates unsolved, iconic stories across the globe. This is right out of our playbook. With direct audio from the hit TV show, we'll hear Gates explore stories like the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, which we've talked about on our show, to the location of Captain Morgan's treasure in Panama, which, as far as I know, we have never talked about on our show. But these authentic roughshod journeys help Gates separate fact from fiction and learn the truth behind compelling stories. And wait for it, he investigates the mysteries of the Bermuda Triangle. His investigation led him to the ocean floor, to the skies above, and even the edge of space to tackle some of the most intriguing disappearances in history. And this is what I've been saying to you, Ken. It isn't just the ocean floor. It goes to the very edge of space. And in the conclusion of his epic investigation, Josh used cutting-edge technology to investigate the Triangle's most infamous shipwrecks and lost flights. Will he find answers to just how the Triangle works, or will it forever remain a mystery? Tune in to Expedition Unknown wherever you get your podcasts.
We all know that feeling. You finally manage to get away on vacation and the worrying starts. Will that bogus beware of dogs sign keep your home safe? What about that fake camera you set up? And will someone finally find your old hide and key rock? That's where ADT comes in. All that stuff, it's safe-ish. It seems fine when you don't really think about it, but you know it truly doesn't work. Instead, ADT provides security solutions that keep you actually safe, giving you real peace of mind. Because vacation is supposed to be, you know, relaxing. Don't settle for safe-ish. Visit ADT.com today to learn more.
But that day at the fort, Alexis San Martin is buying his, whatever you would buy, hardtack
and beads.
Cider. Beads? Yeah. Do you need beads?
Well, you gotta give the First Nations people something for the beavers, right? I mean, what would it be? Bullets? Blankets? You gotta trade. They're not just pulling beavers out for nothing.
I guess that's right. Yeah, maybe he's buying trade goods.
Yeah.
Anyway, somebody is testing out a shotgun in the store.
No.
You know, the kind of thing that happens at Red State Walmarts to this day.
Sure, I thought that this was something only Dick Cheney did. Somebody accidentally shot him with a gun in a store?
In the store, clean up on aisle six.
Oh, no.
So, from 3 feet away, somebody just lets loose with a shotgun full of duck shot.
Oh.
Grape shot? I don't, what would it have been?
A buckshot.
What's the difference between buckshot and grape? Is grape shot really the size of like a table grape? Those would be huge.
Grape shot is just like scrap metal and garbage parts.
Why is it called grape shot?
Because it's like it's a bunch of them, like a bunch of grapes. Bunch.
I assume they would be the size of grapes.
No, it's very, grape shot is very irregular, and it's put into cannons to like shoot at ships and stuff. It's like Well, and it's also, I guess, anti-personnel. Like as armies get closer and closer to your cannons, you can't really shoot cannonballs. So you just throw a bunch of garbage in there and it just shoots shrapnel at people.
You know, when I don't eat enough grapes, I'm also very irregular.
Hmm. Thanks.
So I know how that feels.
I hope our listeners are still not eating. They're putting down. They're putting down.
We should have a trigger warning on this episode. Like, you should not be eating or ingesting through your tentacles or whatever you do, like anything through any part of this episode.
It may be that futurelings eat humans. They may be listening to this podcast and it may be inspiring some portion of them.
It's appetizing.
They may be, well, that, or they might be, some of them
are becoming vegetarians.
They're like, listen, these grubs that we eat actually like think and read and stuff.
The first like time we mentioned a vagino whatever fistula, they're like, nope, I'm just going to eat hedge mazes from now on. It's all hedgerows from now on. So the wadding and the buckshot just flies into him, his torso from 3 feet away.
Ugh.
And bits of his shirt fly in there.
Whoa.
His shirt catches on fire. Oy. So everyone thinks he's a goner. They run for the medical guy at the garrison, who is one William Beaumont. He runs up, and he doesn't know it yet, but this is the meeting that will change his life.
A gut shot, a gut wound like this is considered one of the most painful injuries you can sustain.
Right. Like in the Civil War, people would just hope to get shot in the heart or the head, not in the gut, because it would be such a slow, ugly death. And it would get infected.
Right.
Infection was everywhere back then. Not like today on Mackinac Island, which is beautiful.
Well, they have penicillin on Mackinac Island now.
They also have a silent C. It's not Mackinac.
Right. Mackinac.
It's like...
Well, there's a jacket called the Mackinac.
And you
named after the island, must be.
And you don't say a Mackinac jacket?
You don't.
Do you say a Mackinac jot? Does it make all the C's retroactively silent? There's got to be other words with a silent C. Oh, indict. Indite has a silent C.
Well, I guess, I guess Indite does have a silent C.
I like how you really can tell this is a conversational dead end and not a fistula. Yes, let me repeat the thing you said.
Silent C's. I'm just my mind is now occupied trying to like track down all the silent C's. And definitely, if you're going to email or at us at Twitter about all the words that you know that have silent C's, just at Ken. I don't need to.
I'll make sure to copy John or possibly oppie him. And so William Beaumont was summoned. He immediately, as you say, thinks this is fatal. He does not think that Saint-Martin is going to last 20 minutes.
Right.
As he wrote. His description was that he wrote down was this of the wound. A portion of the lungs as large as a turkey's egg protruded through the external wound, lacerated and burnt. Which you don't want. And below this, a portion of the stomach, which at first I could not believe possible to be that organ in that situation with the subject surviving. The reason why I said that is because there was a puncture in the protruding portion large enough to receive my forefinger. Clearly implied that the first thing he did was just jab his finger.
Poke his finger in there.
As was the style.
Sure, that was medicine.
And through which a portion of his food that he had taken for breakfast had come out and lodged among his apparel. So he could literally see the bread and bacon that Saint-Martin had eaten earlier spilling out of the wound, and he had never seen anything like this.
This is a terrible story.
In this dilemma, I considered my attempt to save his life entirely useless. It is a terrible story. But, shockingly, Saint-Martin does not die.
Does Beaumont provide him medical service?
Yeah, Beaumont does what he can to, you know, stanch the bleeding and I guess get the turkey egg of lung back where it belongs and push the stomach back in through the perforation. But the guy can't keep food down. He doesn't die, but for 17 days, everything they feed him just comes out the hole.
Whoa.
It's like it immediately reappears.
Whoa.
So in Beaumont's notes, he notes that he can only keep the guy alive through nutritional enemas, which doesn't even seem possible to me. Can you spray grape nuts into somebody's nether regions if they can't keep their breakfast down?
You're obviously not a member of the new age adjacent rock and roll culture that I occupy, because at a certain point...
Is this what's going on backstage?
Not backstage, but...
Nutritional enemas in the green room?
As entertainment business people arrive in middle age and cannot believe that they too will age and die.
Look, and it probably happens early considering what a lot of them have done to themselves.
That's right. They immediately switch over from, and sometimes the periods overlap where they're still taking drugs, but also pursuing a health regimen.
You got two hands. You can shoot up and give yourself a nutritional enema at the same time.
But most of the time there's a transition in their fascination with being high, and they go to health, what would you call them? Resorts / retreats where they take enemas.
You're not using this as one example. You're basically telling our listeners that every rock star has an enema phase.
I know.
Like nobody does crystals or juice cleanses.
Oh, there's crystals and juice cleanses included. But I know at least six people, including an ex-girlfriend, who routinely go sequester themselves in Sedona, Arizona, or up in the mountains of New Mexico or Northern California and receive wheatgrass juice enemas and like on the reg, like every day or I don't know, multiple times a day. And they sleep under pyramids made out of copper. And it's all meant, they all are.
Well, you got to do that.
At one point, they maintain a kind of Generation X irony about everything they do. Like, oh yeah, well, it's just a thing I'm going to do. But it's expensive and also invasive and also kooky wah-wah, so that they have to be taking it seriously at the same time.
Well, I always assumed that nutty fattists getting enemas where it was some kind of a cleanse, but you're implying that the body can absorb wheatgrass through the rectum.
Absolutely it can. I mean, if you were just cleansing your body, you would just use castor oil or water, but no.
Just one of those fancy Japanese toilets that sprays you up there.
They'll do coffee, which is, I guess, extraordinary.
That'll wake you right up,
I bet.
It
will. But wheatgrass juice, you just absorb it because your intestine is... Like, it's meant to be absorbing nutrients through the...
Oh, I guess that's true.
Through the...
Yeah, there are...
It's processing your intake into feces by by taking all the good stuff.
I mean,
out.
Most of that's in the small intestine. Large intestine's mostly water, but apparently some ability to get nutrients. If you go and ask for a grande frappuccino up there.
Well, I mean, I have not entered that stage of my post rock stardom where I've just lost all grip and I'm taking retreats where
you haven't entered that stage and that stage hasn't entered you.
That's right. Nobody's ever put like a succession of Tootsie Rolls up me as a part of my transition.
No, more recreationally, not nutritionally.
Yeah, sure. That was stuff we did at parties, but not a thing.
Is this why he was buying beads at the fort? No.
Oh, that kind of beads.
No, probably not.
No. He was buying them to trade, not to. Although, honestly, long
lonely nights out there.
When you're a voyageur and you're out in the forest, you're a forest runner.
Sometimes it's a voyage of discovery,
personal discovery. So he was, but he could not keep food down. So he was only getting nutrient
through wheatgrass enemas, like he's Keith Richards or something.
But at what point is he able to start? Well, I'm presuming, because we're talking about him, that he survived this wound.
Nope, he died then. That's the end of the story. Listeners, from our point in your distant past, social media may not even exist. No, that is not the end of the story. After 17 days, his digestive cycle started, but what shocked Dr. Beaumont was that the fistula remained.
What Shocked Dr. Beaumont is one of my favorite softcore porn novels.
It's like one of those Victoria things where you go to the pier in Brighton and you look through to these naughty shenanigans. What Shocked Dr. Beaumont? He wrote, by the adhesion of the sides of the protruded portion of the stomach to the pleura costalis and the external wound, a free exit was afforded to its contents, and thereby effusion into the abdominal cavity prevented. So food no longer stopped leaking through the pleura into the interior of the body, because the skin knitted directly to the stomach. The stomach became more firmly attached to the pleura and intercostals by its external coat, but showed not the least disposition to close its orifice by granulations, which terminated as if at a natural boundary, and left the perforation resembling, in all but a sphincter, the natural anus with a slight prolapsus.
Why would the body do that?
The body just knows how to make an anus, I guess. It's deep within our DNA.
Wow.
I mean, it's a weird thing gone awry, I guess. I assume our genes are not designed. I mean, things have to knit back together.
Right.
But in this case, he got a new second anus right below his left nipple.
So the skin, being intrepid in all manner,
great at healing over or else we'd die,
found itself touching the stomach and said, sure, why not? And just did its knitting just, magic.
That's right.
Whoa.
And so the next year, Beaumont actually took Saint Martin with him back home. When he was transferred to a different post, he brought him with him, you know, writing and telling people that he was doing this through mere motives of charity.
Yeah.
But their relationship became very problematic from this time forth, because it essentially became kind of a master and servant thing, where he brought Saint Martin with him back home. You know, he would do menial chores around the house. He would chop wood and clear brush and whatnot. And all the time, Beaumont is telling him, I'm going to try to sew up your new second left nipple anus now that you've got. I'm sure that's what he called it.
Mm-hmm. Second left nipple anus.
Never. That implies that he has more than one left nipple anus.
The second left nipple anus is a minor planet that for a little while was vying to be considered one of the nine planets.
We're back to all the pulp sci-fi stuff from the Angels of Mons.
This is an example of how the early 19th century had very different rules about indentured servitude than we have now. Now it's prohibited. You could just save a guy's life and say, get to chopping.
And Saint Martin was very grateful and eager to help this guy out who had gone to such great lengths to save his life.
He had a fatal wound, fatal in every other instance. And here he is, he just has a front anus.
But
he's alive.
And I'm not sure how aware he was that Dr. Beaumont looked at the bread and bacon spilling out of this guy's hole and immediately saw, if you'll pardon the expression, his meal ticket.
That's terrible.
Because
that's an example of one of the things that you say that then people write us and say, Ken is so funny. And I go, yeah, he's okay. He's funny, I guess.
Yeah, just so you know, if anyone ever contacts us across the millennia to say that I'm the funny one, like, it just ruins John's entire week.
All day long, the bread and bacon just spills out of me in rage.
Look at all the smashed guitars on the floor of this room.
You just throw these puns out all day long, and I feel like you're the...
Is that really a pun?
No, but that's typical of you.
I was just going to say it was his meal ticket, and then I realized, like, he was literally looking at the dude's meal.
Yeah.
You know?
I got the joke.
It's not my fault, though. Like, I don't have a piece of paper here that says, say meal ticket.
So here he has this now captive... medical experiment.
Captive Quebecois.
That he's also using as a servant whilst also experimenting on him?
Yes.
What are his experiments?
He later prints a book with 240 different experiments he's done on poor Alexei to study human digestion. And to this day, we call Dr. William Beaumont the father of gastric physiology because he had a front row seat.
Sure.
So he would, for example, dip different foods in there and watch them get digested and compare the rates.
And then pull the half digested food out and he was watching his clock.
And this was very uncomfortable. He noted that this was visibly uncomfortable to Alexei Saint-Martin every time he'd stick a little sack into his left nipple anus.
Yeah, Saint-Martin is being used as a fondue pot.
He's a This was actually the origin of fondue. It's not French Swiss, it's French Canadian.
He has a little fork and he sticks some bread in there.
And you sit around and talk about wife swapping for a few minutes and then you pull it out and see what happened to the little piece of potato or whatever. He would sometimes, like, he was very interested in how body temperature affected digestion. So he would often pull out, he would also remove gastric acid with a tube, mm-hmm. with a rubber tube. So he could make his own little test tubes of gastric acid and then do his own external things. Mm-hmm. So he could be like, hey, Alexei, why don't you go polish the silver? I've got a substitute stomach for you here. But he wanted to see how body temperature affected this. So often he would remove gastric acid from Saint-Martin's stomach, put it into some little vial, start his experiment, and then he would have Saint-Martin insert it into his armpit, luckily. Uh-huh. There are worse places, I guess, he could insert it. Uh-huh. And he would just be like, hey, could you keep that there for an hour or for 3 hours?
Like,
heat
up my test
tube? Or in some cases, for 24 hours? Yeah. Could you also be my lab body temperature heater?
Bunsen burner? Why didn't he just put it over a fire?
I guess he wanted the exact human body temperature.
Oh.
And he's not going to do it himself. I mean,
an external body temperature. That's not the same as a...
Yeah, I don't know. Is your stomach 98.6 degrees right now?
I don't know either.
I guess I assumed mine was.
Is your
It depends on if I've just eaten a snow cone.
Your armpit and your stomach are the same temperature? I mean,
Exactly. This is the kind of thing he would be able to find out. You and I are just sitting wondering, hey, what temperature is my stomach right now? But only Dr. William Beaumont in the world can stick in his finger.
Wow.
And there's a class issue going on here. Saint-Martin is a poor, illiterate man. He's French Canadian, which I'm sure registers as a phrenological racial difference in Beaumont's advanced Caucasian mind, he would think.
Sure. Now, where is this all taking place?
He moves around, upstate New York, Vermont. He's moving around the northern United States from post to post.
Oh, so he continues, he doesn't just become the father of gastroenterology and then sets up shop, but he's also still working as a doctor.
He's still working for the military. And in fact, he arranges for Saint-Martin to become some kind of,
valet.
Yeah. Some kind of military, not adjutant, but some kind of secondary military status so that he gets a stipend and whatnot. And it seems like he's doing him a solid, but really he just doesn't want to have to pay for Alexei's room and board.
Right.
So he arranges for the US Army to do it. And at some point, Saint-Martin starts to get fed up with this. I mean, at some point he must be realizing that it's not in Beaumont's interest to sew him up.
Right. It doesn't seem like over the course of several years, if Beaumont was saying, I'm definitely going to sew up this hole, I just need to stick three more forks of cheesy bread.
See, so once the fondue pot is empty.
Yeah, then Saint-Martin must, eventually start to get wise.
At some part, he must catch on. I guess it reminds me of the Fantastic Four comics I would read as a kid, where Reed Richards would constantly be telling his best friend Ben Grimm that he can turn him from the Rocky Orange Thing back into a normal man. I promise I'm going to do this. But at the same time, the Thing keeps saving his butt by beating up Dr. Doom or whoever.
Uh-huh.
So Reed Richards is not motivated to turn Ben Grimm back into a normal human.
Well, I'm really sorry that the Fantastic Four never really appealed to me as a comic book reader in the 1970s. And so the only time I really read that comic was when I got a copy at a birthday party or something, kind of like against my will.
So I'm giving you bad memories of like the boring comics you had to read.
Yeah, it's just like the Silver Surfer or whatever. That stuff was just way too outré for me.
You're a more meat and potatoes man.
I was reading.
Not unlike.
Mad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You preferred the funny comics.
Yeah,
because these Silver Surfer kind of things were very ponderous, kind of Stan Lee, cosmic moralizing.
Yeah, cosmic moralizing. That's exactly what I was not in for in 1977.
But, you know, now that you're an aging rock star, you're going to go live under the Copper Pyramid and read Silver Surfer comics in Taos.
Maybe I should do. Maybe that's what's missing from my life.
So anyway, Reed Richards, you know, we think of him as a hero, but really he's a mad scientist because he's not. He won't sew up the thing. And this is the same thing where at some point, it's not the same the thing, but
yeah,
it's right. The same situation where Saint Martin must wonder, hey, there's no record of unsuccessful experiments to sew up the fistula, which at least, you know, I can think of a dozen cases where Reed Richards tried to fix Ben Grimm. We don't even know if Beaumont tried that much because this is his, you know, ticket to fame and fortune.
So was it uncomfortable for Saint Martin when Beaumont wasn't sticking his finger in there? I mean, if he was just walking around, did it cause him any discomfort?
No, I don't think so. It was fully healed. He would still have to be careful when he ate because food could still spill out. But there was no physical discomfort. He was homesick. He did not want to live on some army garrison in Vermont with some guy prodding at his left nipple anus.
He wanted to go back to Quebec and meet a nice lady that didn't feel like this was a deal breaker for her.
That's exactly right. And that's what he did.
Ken, you and I both have spoken at great length about how many mysteries of the unknown and unexplained captivated us when we were kids. And some of those mysteries remain unexplained. We were talking about the Bermuda Triangle just the other day. Whatever happened with that? Did we just decide to stop investigating it after all of those planes and ships disappeared? Well, you probably enjoy, as I do, Expedition Unknown, a television show that's now starting its 13th season on Discovery. And lucky for us, there's a podcast called Expedition Unknown, where the host, Josh Gates, investigates unsolved, iconic stories across the globe. This is right out of our playbook. With direct audio from the hit TV show, we'll hear Gates explore stories like the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, which we've talked about on our show, to the location of Captain Morgan's treasure in Panama, which, as far as I know, we have never talked about on our show. But these authentic roughshod journeys help Gates separate fact from fiction and learn the truth behind compelling stories. And, wait for it, he investigates the mysteries of the Bermuda Triangle. His investigation led him to the ocean floor, to the skies above, and even the edge of space, to tackle some of the most intriguing disappearances in history. And this is what I've been saying to you, Ken. It isn't just the ocean floor. It goes to the very edge of space. And in the conclusion of his epic investigation, Josh used cutting-edge technology to investigate the Triangle's most infamous shipwrecks and lost flights. Will he find answers to just how the Triangle works, or will it forever remain a mystery? Tune in to Expedition Unknown wherever you get your podcasts.
We all know that feeling. You finally manage to get away on vacation and the worrying starts. Will that bogus beware of dogs sign keep your home safe? What about that fake camera you set up? And will someone finally find your old hide and key rock? That's where ADT comes in. All that stuff, it's safe-ish. It seems fine when you don't really think about it, but you know it truly doesn't work. Instead, ADT provides security solutions that keep you actually safe, giving you real peace of mind. Because vacation is supposed to be, you know, relaxing. Don't settle for safe-ish. Visit ADT.com today to learn more.
A few years later, he just skipped out without warning and went home. Left in the night. Took his Nippolinus with him.
Required no special care.
Yeah, he didn't need Dr. Beaumont anymore, but Dr. Beaumont really needed him. So he was gone for years. By the time Beaumont catches up with him, he is now married to Marie. I'm sure some sturdy French-Canadian voyageuse for whom this was not a deal breaker.
Right.
And has 6 kids.
Whoa! Good job, Saint-Martin!
And Beaumont agrees to bring them all with him. So suddenly he's got a French-Canadian family of 8.
Well, now, agrees to? It sounds like Saint-Martin had no interest in... How did he get recaptured along with his 6 kids?
He talked him into it, and there was a deal of here's what you're going to get paid, and here's how I will agree to take your family. But Beaumont was not happy about any of this. Saint-Martin was constantly pushing for him to, you know, provide better for his family or to give Marie work. And he was very resistant to put down the cash. And as a result, Saint-Martin ran away again in 1831. And we have records, we have letters where Beaumont stews to friends about Saint-Martin's villainous obstinacy and ugliness. You know, he could not imagine that his human guinea pig would not just want to stick around living the good life, having him jab his fingers into him.
So obstinate.
Morning, noon, and night. Yeah. I feel like maybe we're all obstinate to that degree. That's kind of a funny example of racism, you know? Like, he didn't want me to stick his fingers in them. Oh, those stupid, stubborn French Canadians. Can you imagine?
You know, the issue of racism against French Canadians is really a big deal to French Canadians.
Well, you can imagine.
Like, but no one else in the world even recognizes it or even understands that it exists.
Well, I get it, because they're the biggest minority group in their country, a country that otherwise is entirely Anglo culture.
But they're an enormous portion of
sure.
it. And also my experience in traveling through French Canada is that they feel the same way about the French.
They are culturally very different from the French. And even linguistically, like, it's very hard for a French person, I think, to understand a Quebecois accent and vice versa.
And that they're resentful toward the French in equal measure to their resentment to their fellow Canadians and English speakers and, I think, everyone.
So you're just saying they are villainously obstinate and ugly.
They're extremely...
They're a proud people. Let's say that in case they're listening.
I think they are a proud people. I find them very, very interesting and... I'm sorry. I don't mean to suggest that they are just a science experiment.
We get in trouble when we joke about the Belgians and the Dutch. And I assume we're now going to hear from French Canadians as well. So nice work.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, their motto is Je me souviens. Literally it means I remember. But the way they use it, it basically means we won't forget.
It means I have a grudge, basically.
Yeah, we won't forget either your villainy or their villainy or any all of the ways in which we have been mistreated.
Do you think Canada numbers, do they just number the First Nation, or is it like First Nations?
And then Second Nations?
Second Nations, us. Third Nations, French Canada.
No, the French were there before. So I think the French have the right to be thought of as the Second Nation. The French, you know, the original forest runners were there in like 1600, 1603. They were early, wow. early on original explorers of that region. So, no, they're the Second Nation people. And, you know, je me souviens. I remember.
You do remember.
I mean, I remember on their behalf.
You're 400 years old.
I'm remembering now.
In 1833, Saint-Martin and Beaumont, I didn't even try for a segue there, by the way.
No, that's good. Just rolling on the river.
I guess, yeah, I hope listeners don't mind that I'm not really killing myself to be like, well, let's jump forward from the 1600s, 233 years.
I think it's understood that we are trying to cover this material, and it's easy to get sidetracked.
I'm just an angry substitute teacher trying to get to the bottom of the of the syllabus for the day so I can start the movie. He left for good in 1833 in a contretemps about money.
Mm-hmm.
He probably would have said it in a weird French-Canadian accent. Probably involving salt pork or something. I have no idea. And he never saw Beaumont again. He returned to the woods.
And he never saw Beaumont again was a sequel to the original.
What Shocked Dr. Beaumont?
What Shocked Dr. Beaumont?
That's the sad ending to the things that shocked Dr. Beaumont. They had, because they do have a very intimate relationship when you think about it. Always sticking your finger into some other guy's midsection.
As intimate as it comes.
He would often take his finger out and taste it.
No.
He would take the food out and taste it.
No.
Well, there wasn't lab tests for a lot of this stuff. You know, here's how you diagnose diabetes in the 1830s. You would take a swig of pee and see if it tasted sweet. Huh. So, you know, that's how he would report his findings. He would pull out a piece of chicken from the dude's stomach and take a bite and be like, this is a bland but sweet, you know?
Uh-huh. So Beaumont not only saved the man's life, but is like parasitically feeding off of him.
Yeah, literally. I don't know if there's a romantic angle here to get into or not, but yeah, like he's a guinea pig in every sense of the word, you know, as far as the kind of dignities that have been stripped away from him. And I'm sure that informs why he left and why he didn't come back. He was still in demand, even out of Beaumont's thrall.
Because at this point, Beaumont has published his findings.
Beaumont published his 240 experiments, which did not sell that well. I read in, I think it's in Mary Roach's book about this, that he was constantly haranguing military and governmental friends. Hey, do you want to buy 100 copies of my book, Experiments Upon the Gastrointestinal Regions, or whatever it was called? But it was not a hit.
Right.
He would always be forcing it on friends, and they'd be like, thank you so much for your gift. I can't wait to get into this.
Although, like, gastroenterology is a major part of contemporary medicine because people suffer from all kinds of maladies.
Yeah, although I think Roach also points this out, that he may not have discovered all that much.
Oh, right.
Despite his decades of experiments.
He's just goofing around with digestion, and meanwhile people are dying of Crohn's disease and he's not doing a thing.
Yeah, like he's not telling anybody to drop gluten.
Oh, because he didn't take this Saint-Martin thing and specialize in gastroenterology with other people. He just had this one patient that he just messed around with.
Well, a lot of his findings were not new. There are Italian scientists that had already done this with like animal stomachs. You know, you could perforate a sheep's stomach and dip stuff in.
Right.
And see the progress of digestion over time.
The sheep just wouldn't live for 20 more years.
So digestion was understood pretty well.
I see.
This
was just some super creepy Ed Gein style early Dahmer situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, come into the house, Alexei. We all float in here. He never seems to have discovered the role of enzymes, for example. He was obsessed with gastric juices because acid was something you could, you know, a physical process that somebody without a microscope or lab tests could watch at work. But he never really understood that most digestion actually happens, we now know, in the small intestine. It involves enzymes like pepsin. The main purpose of gastric acid, we now understand, you know, we all have, this is going to gross out futurelings who have much more efficient systems. But the reason why we have this incredibly strong hydrochloric acid, you know, just inches from our throats, is mostly as an immune measure, I guess. It helps kill bacteria entering the body.
Oh.
Like, that's what helps keep you safe from whatever's in your drinking water.
So, but enzymes were discovered contemporaneously, right? I mean, this is about the same era that enzymes were discovered, just not by our man.
Beaumont's not doing that work. Huh. He's just sticking chicken in a hole. Which was not a euphemism at the time. So it was he could totally say that at parties.
Sure. Chicken in a hole, kicking out dough, right?
Yeah, like as his debut rap single said, make it rain, gastric acid. But Saint-Martin had other so Saint-Martin became a celebrity through this book, mm-hmm. and he would occasionally get inquiries. In 1837, there were a bunch of American vegetarians that wanted to start sticking apparently carrots and celery sticks into him instead to hopefully publicize their cause.
A less fun fondue.
Right. A more nutritional fondue.
So he's a classic example of an author who became famous and no one actually read his book.
That's right.
Let's hope that's not true of you and your new book that's coming out soon.
Well, you know, maybe the subjects of my book, the comedy writers I write about, will get the fame like Sam Martin.
They are just as appealing to me as a carrot dipped in gastric juices.
That's actually true if you've been in a lot of writers' rooms. In 1840, he even got a call from London. People, a group of London doctors wanted him to come stand on a stage and show off his hole. We talked about the mummy parties, right? Where scientists would unwrap a mummy in some kind of quasi-sexual way while women fanned themselves.
Right.
And I think this was the same kind of thing. You know, stand on a stage at the Odeon and we're going to stick chicken in you.
Wow.
What a weird life, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there were so many of that kind of, like, come see the world's tallest woman sort of, I guess, what they called freak shows. But this, he was a standalone. He didn't need a snake eater there with him. He was fascinating enough on his own.
Right. But imagine how that must feel, to just feel like your whole body is just an appendage to your left nipple anus. You know, like, what about me? What about my feelings, yeah. Dr. Beaumont? You know, yeah. Like, my eyes are up here, you know, not under my left nipple. In 1853, Beaumont died. He slipped on some icy steps.
Oh, no. He met an inglorious end unconnected to his wound?
This was Beaumont. This was the doctor.
Beaumont. Sorry.
Yeah, so I guess you're right. There is some cosmic justice there. The kind of, you know, if anybody can navigate a set of icy steps, it's a Canadian voyageur.
Right.
So Saint Martin could have, you know, would have easily saved himself, but
Beaumont
took
and died.
A fatal spill and later died from his injuries. Saint Martin died years later.
Oh, he survived Beaumont. Good man.
Yeah, and apparently still had quite a bit of animus. The instructions left by his family were that his body not be buried until it was rotting, ew, and that he be placed in an unmarked grave, because they were afraid of medical men, of grave robbers that would try to continue their experiments posthumously on poor Alexei.
Oh, right. This was the era when if you were a famous person, your organs would be pickled and put in jars and put on display.
And doctors couldn't get cadavers, so they were always hiring Scottish thugs to go dig them up. If you were a Scotsman at this period, you were set for life, because you could just go dig up bodies. They were called resurrection men.
Oh, we're going to get letters from Scotsmen.
They know.
As a Welshman, you know, we were also treated poorly.
The Scots know about their legacy of
grave robbing,
of mausoleum related crime and infamy.
So he died, and his relatives would rather that he lay in state until he's decomposing rather than
risk having put him in the ground where they couldn't keep an eye on him.
Wow.
And his hole. There's even a record of them sending a telegram that reads, "Don't come for autopsy, will be killed."
Yeah.
That's how they settle their hash up in North Canada.
I have a new signature for my emails.
But this is kind of an ongoing issue we have with grappling with medical ethics from the past. Have you been following this story this week about the father of, not of gastroenterology, but of modern gynecology, J. Marion Sims? He was just an incredibly influential gynecologist whose work with fistulae, it all comes back to fistulae, saved so many lives. But this week, a statue of him was removed from Central Park. I say this week, but thousands of years in your past.
Yes.
After standing for a century or more, the statue was removed because he did all of his experiments on African-American slaves, often without anesthesia.
Uh-huh.
Even though ether existed at the time.
Why waste it?
Well, there was some discussion of how widely used ether was. Some people used it, some people did not. It took a while for it to catch on. Doctors are, you know, set in their ways. But there also was this belief at the time that black people, people of other races, did not feel pain in the same refined way that the nobler races did.
Sure, a white woman could be taken, overcome with a case of the vapors,
right,
and probably be given as much ether as she could handle.
But, you know, you have a black slave and
you can cut right into them, and
he would just leave sponges in people and they would die of
sepsis.
And eventually this all worked, and he did discover how to heal these fistulae. but with a trail of unanesthetized bodies.
Sure, it's a Mengelian situation, like Joseph Mengele, who did interesting experiments in the course of murdering Jewish children during the Holocaust.
And Sims is an interesting case because I'm not aware of any kind of medical techniques that we owe to Dr. Mengele. You know, I've never gone into the hospital for a Mengele tonsillitis.
Well, sure, but that was because by that point in time, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and defend the experiments of Joseph Mengele, but that they were suppressed. I mean, it's not like you could ever refer to his work. You know, you couldn't refer to one of his papers as part of, you know, doing experiments on how cold affects your circulatory system.
Yeah, I mean, nobody would want that treatment. Like, that's something I always ask my doctor. Did Dr. Mengele ever try this procedure?
Can we rule out Mengele experiments here? Yeah,
you're right. But we know that Dr. Sims really did manage to figure out the procedure that would solve this fistula that, you know, killed so many women after childbirth.
Right.
Or led to a long life of embarrassing incontinence and dangerous infection.
But just by using actual human beings as lab animals.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I concur with taking his statue down.
You agree.
No one asked for my opinion, but it seems like as we remove statues from our public sphere, because it's revealed that they were... As we gauge the crimes of our forebears relative to our current standards, I think that qualifies as reason enough to remove a statue, right?
And even by apparently the standards of his time, if other doctors were happily using diethyl ether and he was just like, nah, why bother?
I mean, I think we still benefit from the science, but let's not have a statue in Central Park.
Let's put up statues of the recipients, you know? Let's have take down Dr. Sims and put up the slave woman Anarcha, who had to get carved up 14 times so he could refine his fistula technique. And let's put up a statue of
Saint Martin.
Of Saint Martin. It should be in the gift shop at Mackinac Island, you know? I guess the problem is people would just be tempted to shoot it full of buckshot.
Well, or stick their finger in it.
That's right.
And that concludes the Saint Martin fistula. Entry 1227.PR2027. Certificate number 42453 in the omnibus. Listeners, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, please send all your angry tweets to @KenJennings on Twitter. And
that's only for the Scots.
Yeah.
The Quebecois should send their complaints to
@JohnRodrick. Send them to Ken. Let him filter. Only send me the good ones. We have Omnibus Project Instagrams and Twitters and Facebooks.
Yeah, we're willing to compromise our ethical standards and embrace these terrible social media platforms. If it helps create some kind of record of our progress.
Like a lot of mealy-mouthed contemporary people, we both angrily denounce and also socially eschew but still maintain social media accounts.
Well, we're from comfortable Seattle, where the local sport is maintaining these high-minded principles until they inconvenience you in any slight way.
Right, right. And then all of a sudden you quietly abandon them in favor of whatever is expedient and even slightly beneficial to yourself.
Sure. You know, nobody wants low-income housing. Come on.
Not in their neighborhood.
Well, they do want it.
Yeah, sure.
Not within a 3-mile radius of my free parking spot.
Yeah, low-income housing would be great if it happened in the desert somewhere where you never had to see it.
Under copper pyramids.
That's expensive. Copper's expensive. If you've ever ripped out the walls of a house, a la Jesus' son.
No, I believe in a housing first solution whereby
homeless
people get
homes.
Wheatgrass enemas under tents in Sedona.
So you're talking about a wheatgrass first solution.
Yeah, I guess it's really wheatgrass first, but housing like in the top two or three.
You can see my Instagram, which is super fascinating and always entertaining, @JohnRodrick, and you can sometimes see Ken comment hilariously on my posts from his anonymous account @KenJennings. He doesn't even have an avatar. He just lurks.
It might be @KenWJennings, and I don't even know.
What does the W stand for?
Ken Jennings was taken. The W is for
Windsor.
Wisdom. I was named for my older brother, Wisdom Jennings.
Who died
while my mother was in labor with me.
Yeah, right. He was your twin. He was your dead twin right. That you absorbed.
I absorbed my twin brother, Wisdom, whom my parents had already named for some reason.
Sure. They named him first.
Like Elvis, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, just like that. And they had pinned all their hopes on Wisdom.
Well, when you were born, they were like, oh, which one died? Wisdom.
The wrong son died.
If only Ken had died. You can email us at the email address omnibusproject@howstuffworks.com, and we will answer you.
If we can get through the intervening millennia somehow.
Well, and all the... Well, yeah, that's right. If we, as future pasts, we will definitely go on there, wade through all the angry emails from Scots and Quebecers.
It's easy for us to leave messages for them. You know, we can just carve something on a rock and bury it.
Right. Like
them getting the email to us is the hard part, and we appreciate it if you make that effort.
But that's their problem, not ours.
They have the technology, we hope.
Also, as long as Facebook survives as a medium. I'm just doing that to irritate that one guy that keeps yelling at me about the tenses of my Latin.
That time you said the data is what pushed him over the edge, and he's now driving here in a car to murder
datum,
you.
It's datum! We have a fan group there called Futurelings on Facebook, the Omnibus Futurelings.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long this civilization is going to survive. We have no illusions that it's permanent, however. We hope and pray that the eschatological crisis that will end our times will never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. And I'd be okay with that. It was a good one. Mm-hmm. Solid entry. Solid entry into some dude's pleura. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.